A favourite game of ours here at Rare Collections is what we like to call Bill Armstrong Bingo.
Yeah. So how do you play it? Well, we go to the Australian section of the collection and take turns in pulling out an album. The first one to pull out three albums recorded at Bill Armstrong Studios is the winner.
I'm going to pull an Australian record from the shelf here. Check this one out.
Russell Morris, The Real Thing, recorded at Bill Armstrong Studios. Okay, my turn.
Let's Turn Up Your Radio, Masters Apprentices. Also recorded at Bill Armstrong Studios. All right, here's another. We're all someone's daughter.
We're all someone's son. You're the Voice, John Farnham. Bill Armstrong Studios.
Oh, that's a bingo, straight away. Well, what do you know? Bill Armstrong Bingo, where you pull records off your shelf and see whether or not it was cut at Bill Armstrong Studios. At one point, 80% of the hit records that were being cut in Australia were being recorded at Bill Armstrong Studios. So it's a quick game to play, one that's quite entertaining, and you might learn a little bit something while you're playing it too. Welcome to Recollections. I'm Geordie Kilby.
I'm David Kilby.
And this episode, we'll be looking at the...
man behind the studio.
Bill Armstrong. A super influential character in the history of Australian popular music.
We'll take a look at Bill, we'll take a look at the studio and some of the people who passed through it.
Born in 1929, I grew up listening to Fats Waller, Benny Goodman, Marty Shaw, Glenn Miller, all that sort of stuff. And I'd always been fascinated by recordings and collected 78s and just thought that's something I'd like to get involved with, not for the moment thinking I would have achieved much, but I knocked about with jazz bands like Frank Johnson, Graham Bell, Lynn Bernard, Bob Bernard. And I built a disc cutting machine, and that's the first recorder I had in my home, and they'd come around, and they liked to hear themselves back, so I cut acetates of them, played them back to them, and then eventually in 49 I bought a wire recorder, a Pyrox wire recorder, 100 Darling Road, East Malvern. That's where it all started.
In the in the back of your parents' home?
Yes. It wasn't a studio. I mean, it was just sort of a back room with a sort of a big enclosed porch which had a piano in it, and I'd get the band in there and then run a couple of the mic leads out to the back room where I had all my gear, and I'd make recordings of them.
Were your parents encouraging?
They weren't particularly interested, but encouraging, yes. They provided the money for me to do things.
A few years on, and Bill progressed from the wire recordings. He got himself a top-end tape recorder, and he began cutting tunes with some of his mates. The first that he pressed up as a record was Smacker Fitzgibbon, with Graham Bell's band behind him, and it was recorded in a hotel in Victoria in the mid-1950s.
There was a rage on about party sort of records and things made in pubs and all the noise, so I thought, well, here's a good idea. I'll record a lot of this sort of party music. And with Graham Bell, I was talking to him as the band leader for it, and Smacker was a very good banjo player and vocalist. But he was running a pub up in Darnham, which is the... just past, 4 miles past Warrigal in Gippsland. So what we did was we took the band up to the pub, because in those days the pubs were shut on Sundays.
Right.
So we had the band set up, piano, bass, drums, guitar, banjo, and Smacker singing, and invited crowd, most of which were policemen. that's the joke about all these things. The cops were in on anything. And we recorded. I recorded a whole series up there of, and I put them out under the name Frisco Joe's Good Time Boys. Oh, right. Now the reason for that was, at that time, radio stations were very reluctant to play anything Australian. It was a very American English bend in radio stations. But so I thought, well, if we call it something sort of American, it might have a bit of hope. But and the Frisco Joe came about one day. I was having a coffee with Graham Bell at the back of the Musicians Union in Little Collins Street, trying to think up, you know, what are we going to call it? And Graham had a newspaper then. Somewhere it had this this fighter's name, Joe Frisco. And I said, well, why don't we turn that around the old and call it Frisco Joe's Good Time Boys? And that's how that happened. With Smack of the Singing Barman, that's what I called it. And they were very successful.
That's how I feel about someone, how somebody feels about me. We're sure we love each other, that's the way we'll always be.
That's Smacker Fitzgibbon, or Frisco Joe as he's known on the record, being backed by Graham Bell's band and their version of Side by Side, originally released on Bill Armstrong's record label Paramount, subsequently put out on the Magnasound label, but recorded in the mid-1950s. Now, in between recording acts like that, Bill was also working part-time for the ABC, a great technical training ground, and also a really good way to get to know many of the musicians who were playing around Melbourne at the time.
It's called a balance officer then, a music producer. So I worked doing production of the ABC Dance Band and the various small groups, because they used, in those days, used to have quarter hour and half hour segments of nice jazz groups and different bands and things like that. And so that was my job, as a called a balance officer, grade four. Part time, very good time. Most interesting, because I got knew all the musos and people like that, and it was broadcast house in Lonsdale Street was quite a time there. It was good,
and adding to your skills.
Yeah, well, I just sort of learned along the way, and I think I was lucky in that I was very interested in what about it, and I also had some. As I mentioned, a friend of mine, Neil McRae at Phillips, and who taught me a lot of things about the technology of it, and I learned a lot about the, you know, proper use of microphones, because in those days it was, well, Neumann condenser mics were just coming in, and they were very expensive. I bought a Neumann. One Neumann microphone, I think. An M49 Neumann was about £200 then. It'd be about $5,000 now or something. But, I mean, you can buy the same thing now for about $1,500. Mm. So, but they were... So I learned to have... One thing I learned was it's sort of like cameras. You've got to have a really good lens. And so the thing was to have very good microphones. And... then the mixing equipment would be also try to be as good as it possibly could, and the recording machine, tape or wire or whatever, is also to be the primed up to be in its ultimate performance. And tape machines were not tricky, but they just had to be checked out almost daily to make sure they were, the BIOS and everything was set up correctly for that particular brand of tape on that machine, things like that.
A couple of Bill's labels in the mid-1950s were very involved in some of the early excursions into rock and roll that were recorded in Australia, excursions that we'll cover in another program, but they're worth mentioning here. One of them was the Schneider Sisters with their version of Washboard Rock and Roll, or their Rock and Roll EP, which came out on Bill's Magnasound record label, probably the first Australian rock and roll recording that was written by an Australian act. And another earlier recording that was cut by Frankie Davidson for Bill's Danceland label was a very early version of Rock-A-Beatin' Boogie, which is probably the first cover of a rock and roll song done by an Australian artist where they'd heard the rock and roll original and were looking to emulate that sound. That came out on Bill's Danceland record label, which was basically one set up to release recordings by the band leader Max Bostock, who was playing at Bernie Wallace's Ziegfeld Palais in Hawthorne. Now, another popular act who was recording for Magnasound at this time was folk singer Dennis Gibbons.
Dennis Worked at 3AW as an announcer, but he was also a very good folk singer. And I contracted with him to, I think we recorded Jamaica Farewell, Botany Bay, and all a series of those recordings, which I've still got all the master tapes of those, and they were very, very good recordings, and he was such a good singer. And Tom Davidson organised the backing track. And they're really very good. The Money Tree was one another one we did with him. And
Marianne?
I've got, I mean, I've got all these master tapes and don't quite know what to do with them these days.
Right.
But give them to the archives, of course, but it's a pity they're it's difficult to make them heard again.
Yeah.
Except on the ABC, I suppose.
Well, I'm holding a couple of the records here in my hand with, as you mentioned, Jamaica Farewell, Big Rock Candy Mountain, and Mary Ann.
That's right. And Jamaica Farewell is an interesting, there's a clarinet in part in that played by Bert. No, not Bert Pettifer. Bert Pettifer. The two Pettifer brothers. Well, Bert was the leader of the symphony orchestra, violin, and his brother, I'll think of his name in a minute, but he played clarinet and oboe. And we actually recorded Jamaica Farewell with that clarinet, and we did another one with the oboe, but we used the one with the clarinet. But the one with the oboe was all quite lovely too, because it's unusual for have somebody who's good at playing an oboe. But that was not released, but I've still got it.
But the clarinet one was?
Yes.
Yeah. Which would make it certainly different from the Harry Belafonte version.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And Dennis was, you know, a very dedicated folk singer. He was a lovely person. I knew him very well.
But I'm sad to say I'll be on my way. Won't be back for many a day. My heart is down, my head is turning around. I had to leave a little girl in Kingston town.
Between 1956 and 1961, Bill worked for the W&G record label, who had some of Melbourne's biggest acts recording for them, including people like Ernie Sigley and also Graham Kennedy. W&G and Bill had been helping each other out with technical advice and disc production for some time, but there came a point where Bill decided that it was time to join them.
I was not doing very well in selling product. I was good at recording but bad at marketing, so I was sort of going broke, and W&G, who were lovely people and friendly, they said, OK, we want to set up a disc-cutting room. I'd ordered a Neumann disc-cutting machine from Germany, and it was about to arrive, but I didn't have any money to pay for it. So they wanted to set up a cutting room, and they said, OK, look, why don't we give you a job to set all this up? We'll buy all your equipment and you come work for us. So that's how that happened. Then they also issued on W&G some of the recordings that I'd made. I think the ones of Graham Kennedy came out in W&G and as well, things like that.
What did he do?
What, Graham Kennedy?
Yeah.
It's called Smacker Meets Graham, singing Miss Annabelle Lee and a few other things I... Are You From Dixie was another thing, but that was with Tom Davidson's Dixieland Band, which is a very good, excellent recording, great band. Graham was very happy with them. So,
did they sell?
Moderately, yes, moderately.
Was it still difficult to get airplay for Australian records?
Yes, it was. And I can only suspect, I think part of my problem was always recording things that I liked rather than things that might sell. And if you're a marketing person, you sort of figure out what are people going to buy or do. I remember Planet Records, which is set up by Marcus Herman and Bob Crawford. Bob Crawford was a master promoter, and Marcus was the recording guy. But they picked a lot of things that were very saleable. Whereas I was recording, making excellent recordings of things like Smacker and bands and that sort of thing that perhaps didn't have the same sales appeal. That's all I can put it down to, I think. But fortunately, I've got the legacy of some very good recordings that I'd made.
Up until this time, W&G had been recording their artists at different locations around Melbourne, and Bill was involved in helping them establish their own studio, with a little help from the CSIRO.
But I suggested, I think, that they should look at setting up their own studio, because we were recording a lot of material at Coppin Hall and other places, and also, it was quite a big market, I was recording a lot of commercials for Philip Adams and Clemenges and lots of other big agencies. That was the biggest money maker for me, was recording commercials. So I eventually found a church hall behind St James Cathedral in the city, and there was a Sunday school hall behind it, and found out that we could rent it, so we set up W&G Recording Studio there, and with the help of some information from the CSIRO Building Division, and we actually built inside the hall, we built another room inside it to soundproof it, so it was sort of like a box inside the box, and a lot of hit records came out of there. That
like what, Bill?
Do
you remember?
I think of some of Ernie Sigley. Love is a Golden Ring was the first record he made, which I recorded.
One interesting aspect of the business at that time that Bill mentioned there is that he was making great money working on commercials. Ad agencies had big budgets for recording bands for their brands.
The biggest thing I recorded in commercials was the Victorian Symphony Orchestra with the Melbourne Singers doing the Viscount commercial, you know, light up a cigarette, light up a Viscount. I mean, they used to spend heaps, buckets of money on commercials, which later when I opened up Bank Street and Albert Road Studios, they were massive days in commercials with Peter Best and Bruce Woodley and heaps of music writers had offices at my studios, and commercials were a massive part of my business before rock and roll took over.
Right. Do you remember some of the other commercials you cut that are memorable?
In terms of cigarettes, we were doing Viscount, Kent, in airlines, we were doing TAA, Ansett A&A. The Ansett A&A ones were interesting because that's where Farnham, before he became famous and recorded Sadie, he recorded commercials for Ansett A&A Airlines, which Peter Best wrote the music for. And that was, that's where...
That's David the Susan Jones one, wasn't it? Sorry.
Yeah, Susan Jones. And that's where David Mackay, who used to record for EMI in our studio because he didn't like the studio in Sydney. That's where he heard Farnham. And that was the start of Sadie and all the other things he did. but in terms of commercials, we were doing almost Fanta, Coca-Cola, Tarax Lemonade.
Did you record the Coca-Cola ones with the groups in Australia at the time, you know, like the Twilights and the...
Yes, and people yes.
Like, so they're recording right. You did those?
Yes, we did, yes.
The groove are coming on home to the taste of Coca-Cola.
On the road such a long time, yet I'm feeling so lonely, but I'm coming on home now, coming back to my baby.
Following the policy of getting hold of the best equipment he could lay his hands on, he quickly developed a reputation for having the best studio in town. And in fact, that reputation was bigger than just Melbourne too. Producers like David Mackay, who was with EMI in Sydney, would travel south to Bill's place just because of their belief in the superior sounds that were produced there. A big part of the studios that Bill built were some of the great talent that he had working with him. Bill's real love, of course, was jazz, but As the 60s progressed, rock and roll became bigger and bigger, and he moved with the times and he got engineers and technicians who specialised in recording rock bands.
People like Roger Savage, who came out in, I think in the early 60s, he used to work at the Olympic Studios in London, and he actually did the demos for Mick Jagger. At the Olympic Studios in London. When Mick didn't have any money, Roger was working at Olympic Studios, and when he came in with not much money, they put the junior engineer, Roger Savage, on to his session. So he married an Australian girl, and you call it migrate, immigrate, what's the word? I often say it in talking to people that that's the best... 20 quid the government ever spent, because Roger was part of the culture of how good sound things started to sound in Australia. He knew what to do, and he's very cool guy, and he taught a lot of other people, and he was a very important part of. Music in Australia, particularly rock and roll.
Because he worked with the Easy Beats, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah, well, he at my studio, yes. We did one track of the Easy Beats in Albert Road in that small studio. And we had all sorts of great people through the place.
Beats with their single She's So Fine. The backing track, of course, was cut at Armstrong's studio in 1965 before being finished in Sydney shortly afterwards. Just one of the countless hits produced at Armstrong's studios in the 1960s. As Bill said, there were many great acts who passed through his place, but some of his personal favourites, unsurprisingly perhaps, were in the jazz field.
We had Earl Hines, who was Louis Armstrong's pianist. He was a dark gentleman, and he was out here doing a tour, and Neville Sherman, Swaggy Records, who did all his recording, he had Earl Hines come into my studio and record a whole album of Earl Hines. So, I mean, I thought that was pretty good. You had Louis Armstrong's pianist in your studio recording. It's pretty good.
Yeah, and did you get to meet him and spend some time with him? What sort of bloke was
he? No, I think my recollection is really he was sort of just came in and did it and then went away. I mean, Neville might have obviously would have spent time with him, but yep. I didn't. But he was...
Who were some of the other greats then, Bill, that you recall coming through?
Cleo Lane, John Dankworth, Stefan Grappelli.
Bill has been working now in the local recording industry for more than 50 years. His involvement has been so deep that he was awarded an ARIA in 1999 for a lifetime contribution to the Australian music industry. He's also the recipient of the Advance Australia Award for his contribution to industry and commerce. Currently, his big project is the Bill Armstrong Collection, a great selection of CDs that feature remastered recordings by some of the greats, particularly of Australian jazz, people like Graham Bell, Bob Barnard, Don Burrows, Turk Murphy and Tom Baker, to name just a few. He's also been collaborating with old friend Barry Humphries on the So Rare series, which collects remastered recordings of some of Bill and Barry's favourite old gramophone records.
He grew up in Melbourne. He was born in 1934. I was in 1929. So given the war years took up, nothing really happened musically in that period of time. I suppose we were really in the same time frame of listening to the sorts of bands and music. And out of all that evolved him saying, oh, what if you, can you find this singer or this song or that song? And I'd delve into it and find some different versions of a song and things like that, and then send them to him, eventually get them all denoised, put them together and put them out in a very lovely booklet with all of the information about all the artists and the history of them and things like that. Now we're up to number four, so we've done three double CDs of Barry Humphrey's. Oh, it's so rare number. Barry Humphrey's favourite gramophone records is called So Rare, and the latest one has just been released.
Brings us to the end of yet another episode of Recollections. We hope you've enjoyed this one. Please check out the other episodes of the podcast if you've heard this for the first time and enjoyed what you've heard. We've got a big catalogue of subjects we've covered in the past. There's literally something there for everyone. Check us out on Facebook too. We put up the covers of many of the records that we play there, as well as including sometimes audio snapshots that don't always make the programs. You can like us there to stay in the loop. And I tweet about music from time to time. You might find that we have some musical tastes that we share. My handle is at Geordie Kilby. We'll be back in a fortnight's time with more Rare Collections. Thanks for listening. We'll see you then.